So this is Mark Hudson, Trinity Baptist Church, presenting a paper on Hannah Moore, April 1st. Happy April Fool's Day.
You got to be kidding.
It's not really me. Right? Someone else. So by way of introduction, at times we accidentally trip across individuals in history who move us in heart and soul by what they did, and yet we're ashamed to say that we had never heard of them or their work before that point. This is most certainly the case with Hannah Moore. Born in a time of great societal change, she was, in her own way, one of the key instruments of that change. Overshadowed by people more recognizable, such as the politician and abolitionist William Wilberforce, the converted slave trader turned minister John Newton, and writers such as David Garrick, who is a playwright, author, actor, Samuel Johnson, poet, author of a dictionary of the English language, and many others. Hannah, nonetheless, was used by the Lord to help move England to a higher spiritual and moral plane. Most of the factual information in this paper is taken from the book Fierce Convictions by Karen Swallow Pryor. I've not footnoted everything because almost everything would be footnoted. Being a math guy, I believe it's been over 40 years since my last academic paper. This one certainly doesn't fulfill all the referencing requirements of such, but I've done my best to give credit appropriately. Quotes and information from Fierce Convictions are noted by page number. If you've never met Hannah Moore before, I hope you enjoy your first encounter and will plan to follow up with more extensive reading on your own. Early life. Hannah Moore was born on 2nd of February, 1745 at Stapleton, Gloucester, near Bristol. She was fourth of the five daughters of Jacob Moore, who obtained from Lord Botancourt the mastership of the Free School of Fishponds, Stapleton, where he married Mary, the daughter of John Grace, a farmer. His relatives had been generally Presbyterian, and two of his great uncles, Cromwellian captains. He was himself a Tory and high churchman. He and his wife were intelligent and sensible, and desired that their daughters should be so brought up as to be able to make their own living. From the beginning, it would be a challenge for a bright and precocious girl who inherited a world where, in the middle of the 18th century, women's education, when it was attained, was generally limited to the alluring and useful arts, dancing, painting, and speaking French to lure prospective husbands, embroidery, cooking, and sewing to employ once a husband was caught. The idea of teaching young ladies the masculine subjects, such as mathematics and classical language, was seldom entertained and frowned upon when it was. Hannah showed tremendous promise as a learner at a very early age. When her mother began to teach her to read at age four, she discovered Hannah had already done so to a great extent simply by listening to her sister's lessons. At this age, she was also able to repeat her catechism at church, much to the surprise of the parish minister. It was just as well that he didn't know of her delivering sermons to her family from her play pulpit. Her father, steeped as he was with the general spirit of the day, that a girl should not be too learned in the wrong things, grew alarmed at her facility with mathematics and history, subjects that should be left to the boys. He stopped teaching in this area, but allowed her to continue in Latin. She began to learn French from one of her sisters who was studying at school, regularly practicing the language with one of the many paroled French officers living in the neighborhood. All five sisters, Mary, Sarah, who was known as Sally, Elizabeth, called Betty, Hannah, and Martha, who went by Patty, were being prepped to teach an acceptable social role for women of their class. Hannah displayed an insatiable love of words and learning. When gifts were given, her request was always for more paper, a precious commodity at that time. She would fill these with poems and essays, most with some moral lesson. Her paternal grandmother recounted stories of the high price paid by the Puritans under Cromwell. She felt the younger generation undervalued the gospel message so many had risked their lives to follow. Of all the sisters, Hannah took these most to heart, and later in life she would move from mere piety to a genuine faith to a religion of the heart. She was growing up in the aftermath of Whitfield and in the time of the Wesleys. Hers was an age of evangelical awakening. There are discrepancies between initial biographies and those written in more recent times. Though going into detail, there seems to be some support to the argument that Hannah may have painted her family history as more of a rags-to-riches story than can be substantiated by documentation. She was one of those rare individuals who had to adjust to rubbing shoulders with her social betters. Coming from the working class and learning to live above it was uncommon, and there could be few to model it for her. Her memory, especially later in life, may have painted her family history with accomplishments beyond what actually occurred. Her school years. In about 1757, following in the footsteps of her father, who had been appointed master of the free school at Fish Ponds, her eldest sister Mary set up a boarding school on Trinity Street, Bristol, at which she was joined by her other sisters. The five Moore girls were widely known for their piety, intelligence, and high moral character. 12 years spread between the eldest and the youngest. Mary, the eldest, exhibited the traits typically associated with a firstborn. She was responsible, mannerly, and had a take-charge attitude. Just 20 years old when the school opened, Mary was headmistress. 2 years younger, Betty was sweet and warm. Sally, 15, was the sassy sister, witty, funny, and talkative. Next came Hannah. 13 years old when the school opened, she started out as a pupil before joining her older sisters as a teacher by the time she was 16. The youngest, Patty, born 5 years after Hannah, was not only Hannah's baby sister, but also her closest companion and partner in many of her endeavors. The five women were, and remain for the duration of their lives, a sisterhood. The 18th century saw tremendous growth in educational opportunities from boys from working classes, especially in larger cities. Schools were adding subjects such as math, geography, and the natural and physical sciences to the traditional classical offerings. Bristol was one such city. As a port, it became the second largest city in England and benefited from international trade and a variety of commodities. Wealth was no longer tied solely to the land. Those who were not traditional landowners could make profits from these new trading opportunities and were forming the rising middle class. But what about the girls? Traditional views on how much was good for a woman to know were still strong. Few believed girls should receive the same kind of academic training as boys. In his influential educational treatise, Emile, Jean-Jacques Rousseau stated, quote, men's morals, their passions, their tastes, their pleasures, their very happiness also depend on women. Thus, the whole education of women ought to relate to men, to please men, to be useful to them, to make herself loved and honored by them, to raise them when young, to care for them when grown, to counsel them, to console them, to make their lives agreeable and sweet. These are the duties of women at all times, and they ought to be taught them from childhood. Are we taking notes here? This did not leave much room for the three R's or any other academic subject. Support for schools for young girls was not widespread, and it seemed it could do little but upset the natural order of things. An article in the 1763 Monthly Review stated, intense thought spoils a lady's features. A smattering of schools for girls were introduced in the cities in the mid-1600s, and by the mid-1700s, there were a number of rural ones as well. In many small businesses, the wives partnered with their husbands in the working of the business. But as income grew, tradesmen with an eye toward upward mobility strove to imitate their social superiors by turning their wives and daughters into leisured ladies. The Moore School was ready to take a leading role in educating young women appropriately. Hannah eventually developed a style of education for girls that gave them the opportunity to move beyond the superficiality of programs built on snippets of modern languages, music, drawing and painting, embroidery and manners, areas pursued for ornamentation rather than understanding. Progress in such areas was easily measured, whereas an education in intellectual, spiritual, and moral formation develops over time. Its progress cannot be so definitively marked. She certainly believed women had the intellectual capacity for more. She strove to have her students develop a greater exactness in terms of the pursuit of whatever avenue of truth was at stake. In particular, she recommended such exactness in the use of words. It is therefore no worthless part of education, even in a religious view, to study the precise meaning of words and the appropriate significance of language. Adhering to the prevailing view that each sex has some kind of natural bias, she sought to advance female education in order to fulfill women as women, not make them like men. Her overarching question was, is it not better to succeed as women than to fail as men? Teaching was considered one of the few respectable vocations available to single women in the late 1700s. The Moore sisters opened their school at 6 Trinity Street, College Green, Bristol, and showed early on it had every possibility of being a success. Sufficient funds came in through subscriptions, loans, and gifts, But before long, the school turned a profit. In a few years, it had to relocate to larger accommodations and was soon renowned throughout the country, with 60 students enrolled with long waiting lists. The Moore sisters were lauded for their financial management, high principles, and general benevolence in running the school. It ran successfully for 30 years under their direction, and then for another 20 under the direction of a former student. They were respected for their remarkable social skills, respectability, and ability to attract affluent students and patrons. As a teacher, Hannah had an unusually warm teaching style. She encouraged the use of the imagination and was able to bring to light Bible stories, fairy tales, or nursery rhymes. She wrote several plays based on biblical stories, later published as Sacred Dramas in 1782. When an attempt was made to put some of these plays on the stage in Hull in 1793, the effort was prevented by religious conservatives who deemed it profane to enact biblical stories on the secular stage. In spite of her intelligence and wit, she was not a disciplined student or writer, working quickly and impatiently, relying on innate ability. One of the key characteristics of the city of Bristol at this time was its thriving economy, much of which was tied to the thriving British slave trade. After 1698, with the end of the government monopoly on slave trading, many companies took it up as a cornerstone of their trading efforts. By 1730, Great Britain led all other countries in the slave trade. From 1690 to the end of Britain's slave trade in 1807, at least 2.8 million African slaves were carried aboard British ships, 500,000 of them on Bristol's vessels. Add to that the business arising from sugar and tobacco grown on slave plantations in the Caribbean, cotton plantations in the southern U.S. and elsewhere, cocoa and rum. The port of Bristol, with a population approaching 70,000, benefited at every turn from the work of slave labor in many parts of the world. With this added wealth came cultural opportunities, however, for speakers, musicians, actors, and writers. Almost married, but financially set. Women in the 18th century usually lacked the space and support needed to write. Hannah obtained that freedom, but at great emotional and personal cost. The world would never have heard of William Turner, and possibly of Hannah More, if he had not jilted her after their engagement. The initial connection between the two was at their school, where two of William's cousins attended. William's estate at Belmont was extensive and beautiful, and Hannah and Betty often accompanied the cousins there for times of enjoyment. By all accounts, William was a gentleman in every way, noted for his honor, integrity, propriety, and intellect, as well as his good taste in poetry and landscape. Even though there were 20 years between them, their common interests drew them together, and William began a long courtship of Hannah, who was 22 at the time. He provided a room in the form of a cottage on the estate for her private use. She, in reply, took on the role of wife-to-be in helping him with home decoration, gardening, a skill that would grow to levels of great renown later in her life, and quiet companionship. When he proposed, probably in 1767, Hannah would be 22, she readily accepted. In preparation for marriage, she withdrew from the school and committed time and money, in particular to her wardrobe, to becoming the wife of a wealthy man. This period of engagement lasted about 6 years. A wedding date was set once, but William backed out, then a second time, where William again backed out, and a third time where he failed to follow through on his commitment once again. The reasons for this are not really germane to our discussion here, though they have been left largely to speculation and imagination. He begged for one last opportunity, but at the recommendation of her sisters and in line with her own unwillingness to experience the heartache of being turned down a fourth time, she said no. She spent some time recovering from this disappointment near the sea, where she met another man who had lost two previous wives in childbirth. Though Hannah enjoyed their times together, especially riding along the beach, his offer of marriage was quietly but firmly declined. Returning to Bristol in 1773, she turned down William's final entreaty for marriage. He responded by offering her an annuity of £200 a year, an amount large enough to provide her with financial independence and the opportunity to write without fear of hunger or want. Though Hannah initially rejected this offer of help, she was eventually convinced to accept it by friends and family who viewed the situation with greater practical vision than Hannah. It's interesting to note that none of the Moore sisters ever married. Some have suggested that they chose not to lose their freedom and independence through marriage, as once they were married, they would become subject to their husband's name, losing any legal status, and abandon any opportunity to pursue the type of life they had grown to love. A final note on poor William. He continued to love Hannah, and 20 years later stopped in at Cowslip Green, drawn in particular by the beauty of the gardens, and discovered to his surprise and delight that this property belonged to Hannah. They renewed their friendship. He became a regular dinner guest, and she gave him a copy of everything she wrote before it went to publishing. Upon his death, he bestowed a gift of £1,000 to Hannah as a gesture of his admiration and esteem. The theatrical years. Hannah experienced personal suffering through many childhood illnesses, possibly the result of bouts of depression and battles with migraines. Her reading and writing worked wonders during these challenging times. At age 13, as a student at her sister's school, she began to study languages. She was fluent in French before the age of 14, progressed better than most in Latin, was able to translate Spanish poetry, and attended lectures in the theater. She developed a writing style that exhibited the old-fashioned flavor of the 18th century. Her early promise was being fulfilled and noticed by key literary figures such as the romantic poet Samuel T. Coleridge, who later described her as, quote, undisputedly the first literary female I have ever met with, end of quote. In the 1600s, writing had begun to open up as a legitimate profession for women. Middle-class women were beginning to write. Several factors helped bring this change about. As the patronage system, where nobility sponsored the work of artists and writers, began to decline, the printing press opened the door for entrepreneurs looking to make a living off the writings of well-known and lesser-known authors. More people were reading, and there was a growing market for new titles. The need for authors drew many women into the craft. Another factor was the tremendous influence of Puritanism throughout the 1600s, leading to an understanding that the personal experience of each individual was essentially connected to their spiritual formation. Men and women moved toward greater spiritual equality, based on a firmer grasp of scriptures, undergirded by a prayerful, personal reading of the sacred text. Those without formal church training could know things that were important and share them with others. Of course, this spiritual equality began to influence inequalities in other areas of life, and through many battles began to bring them more into a state of harmony. It was not an easy time for women writers to find acceptance and respect. The unfortunate fact that many chose to write novels of questionable moral substance, and then live lives that reflected the same, did not add to their general acceptance as writers who should be taken seriously. Hannah, along with other writers of her day, had to expend some significant energy defending the legitimacy of their work. In an early work, The Search After Happiness, Hannah addresses the challenges they faced in poetic form. Though should we still the rhyming trade pursue, the men will shun us, and the women too. The men, poor souls, of scholars are afraid. We should not, did they govern, learn to read. At least in no abstruser volume book than the learned records of a cookery book. The ladies, too, their well-meant censure give. What? Does she write? A slattern as I live. I wish she'd leave her books and mend her clothes. I thank my stars I know not verse from prose. She could be sarcastic. In one of her letters, she wrote that the woman writer will have to encounter the mortifying circumstances of having her sex always taken into account, and her highest exertions will be received with the qualified approbation that it is really extraordinary for a woman. At this stage in her life, she sought the esteem of both men and women and was prepared to work specifically to achieve it. When she failed, when her work was attacked or overly criticized, she experienced her greatest illnesses and physical setbacks. Networking in the 1700s was just as important as it is today. It simply required more travel, extensive letter writing, face-to-face encounters, and the absolute necessity of being introduced to the right people by the right people. Hannah showed a great adeptness at this latter skill in particular. Being in Bristol, there were many opportunities to meet highly placed people in all walks of life. Hannah's talents were cultivated by a community of patrons, friends, and admirers, many of whom possessed the authority and means with which to promote the fruit of her toils. As a result, she gained widespread admiration, even as a young woman, for her powers of conversation, her demonstrated wisdom and modesty, and her rich imagination. As early as age 15, she managed to arrange an interview with James Ferguson, a painter, astronomer, experimental philosopher, globe maker. The result was a sharing of talents as he imparted hitherto unavailable scientific education to her, and she assisted in crafting some of his writings. Though she backed away from the success accorded a literary figure later in life due to concerns about eloquence and rhetoric as skills that might not be in concert with a proper Christian character, she had no such concerns when she was young. Thomas Sheridan, famous Irish actor and orator, presented a series of lectures in Bristol. Hannah attended and established a lifelong friendship with Sheridan. The initial connection came through a poem she wrote after hearing him speak. If music's charms can soothe the savage breast and lull the busy cares of grief to rest, if magic numbers, if the muse's art, can please the raptured sense and reach the heart, what nobler charms and eloquence are found, where with music sense unites with sound? Oh, could my unfledged muse the theme define, the well-earned praise, oh Sheridan, were thine. That is a major kiss-up at that point, and it seemed to work extremely well. She made friends with John Peach, a friend and editor of the philosopher David Hume, who instructed her in the art of literary criticism. In 1774, Hannah would be almost 29, author Edmund Burke celebrated his political victory outside the Moore Sisters' school, thankful for the verses written by Hannah in support of his campaign. There were numerous individuals drawn into Hannah's sphere over the years. One of the most influential was that of Mrs. Ann Lovell Gwatkin, whose daughter was a student at the school. Her support for the school was very strong, and to her, Hannah dedicated her first published work, The Search After Happiness, 1763. Though considered archaic and quaint, the work achieved its aim. It was a play to be presented by the girls at the school and only included roles that were morally acceptable and without objectionable behavior. This ran contrary to many of the school productions of the day. In the play, the girls lamented their failure to find happiness in pursuits such as courtly pleasures and vanities and in an imagination led astray by the reading of novels. Though written for her students, she published the play later and sold over 10,000 copies through 12 editions. Themes prominent in the play, and which matured through most of her life, included her views on female roles and education, as well as morality and religion. In 1783, Robert Raikes, one of the founders of the Sunday school movement, utilized an English translation from the French Select Moral Tales in his schools, a translation undertaken by Hannah. Then came a final push by her longtime family friend, Sir John Stonehouse, an Oxford-educated clergyman and physician, and a deist turned evangelical. With his evangelicalism in full force, he guided her study and readings in theology, and as Hannah related later, reawakened her religious sense. This was the man who had arranged the annuity from William Turner. Further to that, he sent a copy of her manuscript of The Inflexible Captive to an influential friend in London, the famous London actor and dramatist David Garrick. The door to London was being opened to the young girl who had always dreamed of going there. London. This section of time in Hannah's life will be abbreviated, focusing only on the essential events that prepared her for a work the Lord had in store for her. One of her goals in going to London was to meet the premier actor of her day, the director of the Theatre Royal, the man who helped connect the middle-class actor to the upper-class patron in social settings, David Garrick. With the help of friends such as Dr. Stonehouse, some of Hannah's writings had already been passed his way and met with his strong approval. When they finally did meet in 1774, a friendship was established that lasted not just until Garrick's death, but for 43 years afterward, as Hannah had become good friends with Garrick's wife, Eva Maria Weigel. Garrick opened the door to connections to his entire circle of friends, including writers, actors, artists, even members of the royal family. As described in one of her letters, the greatest names in intellect and taste. Over several winters in London, the list of contacts grew as this young provincial woman seemed to bring a touch of fresh air to the stuffy atmosphere of London life. One of the most significant people to enter her circle was Dr. Samuel Johnson, the man of literature who seemed to define the latter half of the 18th century. In the first meeting, Johnson appeared with a macaw on his arm and greeted Hannah with a verse from one of her very own poems. Of course, they too hit it off, and another long-standing friendship was formed. Even a portrait of Johnson, hung later at Oxford, had the words of one of her poems affixed to it. In conversation with the Moore sisters, he confided that he too had spent a number of years as a teacher to make a living, having had to drop out of Oxford for lack of funds. He admired their independence in starting up such a successful school themselves. In spite of her intellectual contacts, Hannah always struggled with a sense of inadequacy and not really belonging. Even after the successful production of her play Percy in London, which ran for an impressive 22 straight nights, had sold 4,000 copies in 2 weeks, and was performed in Bath, her hometown of Bristol, and across England, France, and Austria, she felt strangely out of place. In spite of the accolades and connections, Hannah still spent most of her time reading and writing, often 5 hours a day with the former and 10 hours some days on the latter. She was paid very well for her best-selling works, and they were immensely popular. Her last work for the stage, The Fatal Falsehood, was well received, but produced some unwelcome notoriety. As in the second night of the play, a woman stood up in the audience and cried out, "That's mine, that's mine." Though the charge of plagiarism seems to be unfounded, this ended Hannah's stage writing for good. Though she continued to visit London for many years, its luster had worn off, and she was about to turn her hand to more sober things. Learned societies. Women of wealth and influence would sometimes act as patrons of people in the arts with no personal means of being heard or supported by their work. Elizabeth Montague, one of the wealthiest and most influential women of her day, and described as the one who had a passion to rule and a passion for power, as well as a passion for literature, was one such individual. She supported numerous female writers, including Hannah. After the early death of her only son, Elizabeth became more serious about her Christian faith and helped others through her philanthropy. She headed up a group that became known as the Blue Stocking Circle. The origin of the name has several possibilities. A loose gathering of intellectuals in the mid-18th century that included both men, such as Garrick, Johnson, Burke, and women, extremely egalitarian for the time, though it increasingly became known for its female members. Hannah had opportunity to act as patron herself for a woman, Anne Yearsley, whose family was destitute, and had written a body of poems, and Hannah arranged to have them published, invested the profits through trustees, and helped Anne do quite well. A dispute, however, broke out about who should control the purse strings. Hannah was concerned that quick wealth might go to the woman's head. After publicly accusing Hannah of using some of the funds to purchase a property, control was turned over to Anne. Though she published a few other small works, Anne eventually faded from the public view. Hannah, however, learned some important lessons about what it is to really help someone. She stated to a friend regarding the prosperity her help had given Anne, "I was afraid it would turn her head, but I did not expect it would harden her heart." She was beginning to see that something more than education, more than wealth, more than influence or power or literary prowess was needed to effect real change in both individuals and society. In this painful situation, it was shown once again that Hannah had been given the ability to bridge the worlds of the great and the low. Crossing such long-established social boundaries was one of the significant examples of the Blue Stocking Circle, one Hannah would follow. The circle differed from the usual social gatherings in England and France, times that were largely filled with drinking, flirting, dancing, card playing, and gambling. Their focus on intellectual conversation, while upholding elite standards of respectability and morality, gave them an apparent air of prudish conservatism. Here it was okay to be both fashionable and proper. The circle arose at a time when women of talent and intellect were just beginning to receive recognition apart from the economic and social status into which they were born. Hannah was also welcomed within other circles that would usually only receive men. The Sauerkraut Party, the Oyster Club, meetings at Adelphi, it's the home of Garrick. Perhaps these were foundational times preparing her for participation within the evangelical Clapham sect at a later date. The circle also promoted a very biblical position of the family, something very important to Hannah, though she never married. The advancements they sought in terms of education and learning were ones that led to the strengthening of the vitality of the family. They would argue for a woman being prepared to be a good wife as opposed to simply landing a good husband. In one of her most influential books, Strictures on the Modern System of Female Education, published in 1799, she stated, "When a man of sense comes to marry, it is a companion whom he wants and not an artist. It is not merely a creature who can paint and play and sing and draw and dress and dance. It is a being who can comfort and counsel him, one who can reason and reflect and feel and judge and discourse and discriminate, one who can assist him in his affairs, lighten his cares, soothe his sorrow, strengthen his principles, and educate his children. This was remarkably progressive thinking for her day. To encourage a compassionate marriage as opposed to a politically correct or expedient one was encouraged by the evangelical mindset, as marriage was an institution to advance the kingdom of God, not property. She believed the ideal of rational domesticity helped to liberate the individual within a supportive family framework. With her conviction of spiritual equality, Hannah pointed devout women toward a greater role in public life in pursuit of the public good. Hannah knew her own heart very well and was concerned about appearing better than one is. It is so easy to practice a creditable degree of so-seeming virtue, and so difficult to purify and direct the affections of the heart, that I feel myself in continual danger of appearing better than I am. And I verily believe it is possible to make one's whole life a display of splendid virtue and agreeable qualities without ever setting foot towards the narrow path or even one's face towards the straight gate. But perhaps the least known, Hannah, the poet of the blues, was included in a portrait in 1779 which featured nine blue stocking ladies entitled Nine Living Muses of Great Britain. Toward the end of the 1700s, with the revolutions in North America and in France, and with Romanticism on the rise, the ideals espoused by the blue stockings quickly went out of vogue, and it became a derogatory term applied to learned, pedantic women, particularly conservative ones, and did not fit well with damsels in distress awaiting the rescue by their assigned knights. Hannah More would survive this shift in perspective and continue to play an important role well into the 19th century. The gold loses its glitter. Between the death of David Garrick, 1779, and her move 5 years later to her country home, Cowslip Green, the thrill of London was quickly wearing off. It is clear that she was undergoing a greater sense of a calling to more serious work, to more devotion in her faith, and with it to ministry and serving others. With several issues souring her love for the stage, she was quietly closing the door to that part of her life. At the heart seemed to be the antithetical nature of the stage and what it produced over against her conservative and religious leanings. Around this time, she came across John Newton's Cardiphonia, The Utterance of the Heart, a collection of letters written by Newton, a book that brought her under ever-increasing conviction. She gave up the theater and writing for the stage. As she stated in her letters, emotions such as love, hate, ambition, pride, and jealousy form a dazzling system of worldly morality, which contradicts the spirit of that religion whose characteristics are charity, meekness, peaceableness, long-suffering, gentleness, forgiveness. She saw no contradiction in terms of writing and reading good literature and continued to pursue those throughout her life. It is possible that when her other dear friend Samuel Johnson was on his deathbed at this time, a letter received from a clergyman urged him first to consider the question, "What shall I do to be saved?" and then to behold the Lamb of God. Johnson seems to receive such great peace from this that there is hope the man was saved before he died. Hannah wrote to a friend, "The more I see of the honored, famed, and great, the more I see of the littleness, the unsatisfactoriness of all created good, and that no earthly pleasure can fill up all the wants, can fill up the wants of the immortal principle within." The aspects of London life that weighed heavily on Hannah's heart included the ludicrous lengths women pursued just in getting properly dressed for parties and events. 6-foot hoop dresses began to shrink in size just as hats began to increase. Going to the play for every performance, where she found herself more and more thinking, "Elijah, what doest thou here?" The vast number of social engagements planned for Sunday, the poor sermons, card playing, gambling, drinking to excess as a way of life, making the serious things of life trivial and celebrating silliness with the utmost seriousness. So in 1785, following the death of her father in 83 and Johnson in 84, More moved to Cowslip Green, a one-story thatched cottage situated in the west of England. Here she was prepared to quietly write and pursue her lifelong love of gardening. She wrote to John Newton, "The world, though I live in the gay part of it, I do not actually much love. Yet friendship and kindness have contributed to fix me there, and I dearly love many individuals in it. When I am in the great world, I consider myself as in an enemy's country, and as beset with snares, and this puts me upon my guard. I know that many people whom I hear say 1,000 brilliant and agreeable things disbelieve, or at least disregard those truths on which I found my everlasting hopes. This sets me upon a more diligent inquiry into those truths, and upon the arch of Christianity, the more I press, the stronger I find it. Faith brought to light. After reading Cardiphonia in 1780, Hannah wanted to find out who the author was, as it was printed pseudonymously. Right. One of the reasons she liked it was, it is full of vital, experimental religion. Vital, indicating it was full of life, and experimental alluded to the growing emphasis on the need of each person to have an authentic and personal faith, rather than simply adhere to rote tradition. It was a big step in her turning toward the Christian faith with more than a casual cultural attentiveness. She recommended the book to everyone she met, and finally decided she needed to meet Newton herself. She came to St. Mary Woolnoth, where Newton pastored, and where evangelical ideas received a sympathetic hearing. She came on a Tuesday to hear him preach, spoke with him for about an hour afterward, and came home with her pockets stuffed with sermons. Newton inspired Hannah to become increasingly evangelical and convinced her to devote her life to promoting spiritual education and reformation across British society. Slavery was such an integrated aspect of the social and economic framework of British society. It was not easily seen by most for what it really was. Britain owned more than half of the world's slave ships. The slave trade provided valuable training ground for naval forces. Abolition of the slave trade would annihilate an industry that put sailors and ships to work, in addition to generating wealth from imports and exports, stated a 1791 declaration in the House of Commons. The cost of emancipation in 1833 was about £20 million, thus plus increased costs for everything that came from the West Indies. Christians were one of the first to oppose the slave trade right from its inception in the 1660s. Among the group was the Quaker George Fox, the Puritan Richard Baxter, Anglican Granville Sharp, and Methodist John Wesley. Opposition increased in some quarters in this age of reason, especially as travel, literacy, and communication were making the horrors of human slavery more widely known. With a mortality rate of about 50% on the slave ships and the highly publicized Zong Massacre of 1781, with its subsequent court decision, fueled the abolitionist fires even more. In that case, 132 slaves were thrown overboard from the British ship Zong to collect on the insurance value of those slaves. Focused on property, profit, and loss, not humanity or morality, the court ordered the insurers pay for the loss in 1783. Voices were being raised in some pulpits through individual writings and even in legal proceedings that sought to stop the buying and selling of slaves. Of course, the one name usually associated with abolition was that of William Wilberforce, the MP who spearheaded the legal effort against slavery and who became one of Hannah More's dearest friends. Since we're probably aware of the key elements of Wilberforce's life, we'll just note a few details at this point. First, Philip Doddridge's classic work, The Rise and Progress of Religion in the Soul, was greatly used in his spiritual awakening and salvation. Agonizing over the state of his soul, he eventually, and hesitantly, and secretly, went to meet with John Newton. The old slave trader's arguments were that Wilberforce could serve God just as well in Parliament as anywhere else, perhaps better. There was no need to escape the public eye, but he should, quote, stay at his post and neither give up work nor throw away wealth, wait and watch for occasions, sure that he who put him at his post would find work for him to do. Wilberforce took his first communion on Good Friday, 1786. Not long after, as one of the first truly public converts through the evangelical revival, he attended the church pastored by Thomas Scott. Wilberforce was troubled by the slave trade even as a young boy. Hannah was less in the public eye at the start than he, yet she too held an anti-slavery stance that harkened back to 1776 when she befriended Charles Middleton, a former naval captain who had helped lead the abolitionist movement. His stories of events aboard the slave ships shocked and angered her. Hannah met William in the fall of 1787 in Bath. Though 14 years her senior, they shared passionate Christian convictions and a determination to see slavery stopped. Hannah helped link William to the world of letters, and he persuaded her not to shrink from the world at large. The relationship would last for 47 years. There'd be two main streams of activism pursued by Wilberforce and Moore throughout their time together. The First was the battle against slavery, and the second was social reform to alleviate the tremendous suffering experienced by so many of the common people in small towns and big cities everywhere. First, abolition. The home of Sir Charles and Margaret Middleton in Teston became the center of activity for the abolitionist movement. Its members often referred to as the Testonites. Lady Middleton took a valuable and effective public role in the movement against slavery, and after Hannah's mother died in 1786, Margaret became a mother figure for her. They rallied friends and supporters in an extensive political, legal, moral, and social campaign against slavery. The names of people involved in those early days include the Reverend James Ramsey, former ship surgeon who had a chance to examine conditions on board a slave ship firsthand. He joined the church and ministered among the slaves in the Caribbean for 27 years, finally accepting an appointment in Kent where he wrote about the horrors of slavery. Thomas Clarkson published a paper against slavery in 1786 and was a founding member of the Committee for the Abolition of the Slave Trade in 1787. And Bill B. Porteous, a good and godly friend of Hannah's, who was made Bishop of London. Hannah said of him, "I rejoice for many reasons, but for none more than his ecclesiastical jurisdiction extending to the West Indies will make him of infinite usefulness in the great object I have so much at heart, the project to abolish the slave trade in Africa." In their search for a sympathetic voice in Parliament, they first looked to Charles Middleton, but he declined and recommended they approach William Wilberforce, who, after receiving the blessing of his good friend, Prime Minister William Pitt, resolved to take it on. On Sunday, October 28, 1787, he wrote in his diary, "God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners." Hannah met William at the Middletons, and they made an immediate connection, enjoying 4 or 5 hours of private conversation on all the great objects of reform. The Moore sisters hosted a number of meetings for the abolitionists at their home in Bristol. They were optimistic that the matter was coming before Parliament in the spring, with lots of hope and matching naivety that real progress would be made quickly. They did not understand the length of time that this battle would require. The abolitionists toiled still, gathering information and gathering evidence and testimonies they hoped would sway the politicians and people's minds, and presenting their arguments and appeals in countless committee meetings and hearings. Fellow abolitionist Zachary Macaulay kept more informed on Wilberforce's progress in parliamentary procedures, women being excluded from these, and sought her advice on the political aspects of the drawn-out campaign. Clarkson was particularly energetic. Thomas Clarkson was given the responsibility of collecting information to support the abolition of the slave trade. Ellen Gibson Wilson pointed out that he traveled almost entirely on horseback, for riding was the most efficient way to go in all weathers and all roads, and he thought the exercise was good for him. It is estimated that he was to ride some 35,000 miles in the next 7 years. His work included interviewing 20,000 sailors and obtaining equipment used on the slave ships, such as iron handcuffs, leg shackles, thumb screws, instruments for forcing open slaves' jaws, and branding irons. And then we have that picture that's fairly famous, the cross-section of a slave ship and how the slaves would have to lie. Hannah was very effective in the spreading of the word about slavery through Ramsay's pamphlets. Most British citizens had little or no idea of what was involved with the slave trade, assuming it was some sort of healthy, symbiotic relationship that both owner and slave enjoyed. More of a master-servant relationship, as one might find in many biblical passages. The explicit detail in these pamphlets was meant to disabuse the readers of such ignorant notions. She was regularly showed a drawing provided by Thomas Clarkson depicting the appalling manner in which slaves were transported. The visual impact of the diagram made it one of the most famous and effective tools in the abolitionist movement. A veil was being lifted, though some very hard-nosed and intimidating men worked feverishly to keep it drawn. Hannah and many others began a boycott of West Indian sugar to protest the use of slaves on the great sugar plantations. The most public part of this boycott was led by the Baptist abolitionist William Fox. An anonymous satirical poem appeared in print in 1792, and it is believed to be the work of Hannah. "I own I am shocked at this purchase of slaves, and fear those who buy them and sell them are knaves. What I hear of their hardships, their tortures and groans, is almost enough to draw pity from stones. I pity them greatly, and I must be mum, for how could we do without sugar and rum? especially sugar, so needful we see. What? Give up our desserts, our coffee and tea? A more serious work of hers, however, was the poem Slavery, written in 1788, just before Wilberforce was to present a resolution in Parliament to consider limits on the number of slaves that could be put on a ship. This formed part of an all-out arts abolitionist campaign that coincided with Newton's pamphlet, Thoughts Upon the African Slave Trade, called by Newton A Confession Which Comes Too Late, and William Cowper's poem, The Negro's Complaint, with Cowper being one of the most read poets of his day. Cowper's poem was written to the tune of a popular ballad sung by the lower classes, but also printed on high-quality paper to appeal to upper-class buyers. In the previous year, the nonconformist Josiah Wedgwood manufactured the famous Jasper medallion that was based on the seal designed for the Cast Group and was copied on numerous items in the coming years. And that, again, I'm sure you're familiar with. To get a sense of her passion and sincerity in her writing, here's a sample, a couple of excerpts from Slavery. Slavery runs on for 300 or 400 lines. Let me just read this portion, two sections. I see, by more than fancy's mirror shown, the burning village and the blazing town. See the dire victim torn from social life, the shrieking babe, the agonizing wife. She, wretch forlorn, is dragged by hostile hands to distant tyrants, sold in distant lands. Transmitted miseries and successive chains, the soul sad heritage her child obtains. Even this last wretched boon their foes deny, to weep together or together die. By felon hands, by one relentless stroke, see the fond links of feeling nature broke. The fibers twisting round a parent's heart, torn from the grasp and bleeding as they part. Hold, murderers, hold, not aggravate distress. Respect the passions you yourselves possess. And then towards the end of the poem. And now her high commission from above, stamped with the holy characters of love. She's speaking here of liberty in England. The meek-eyed spirit waving in her hand breathes manumission o'er the rescued land. She tears the banner stained with blood and tears, and liberty thy shining standard rears. As the bright ensign's glory she displays, sea pale oppression faints beneath the blaze. The giant dies, no more his frown appalls. The chain untouched drops off, the fetter falls. Astonished echo tells the vocal shore, oppression's fallen and slavery is no more. The dusky myriads crowd the sultry plain and hail that mercy long invoked in vain. Victorious power, she burst their twofold bands, and faith and freedom spring from Britain's hands. And thou, great source of nature and of grace, who of one blood didst form the human race, look down in mercy in thy chosen time, with equal eye on Afric's shore, suffering climb. Disperse her shades of intellectual night, repeat thy high behest, let there be light. Bring each benighted soul, great God, to thee, and with thy wide salvation, make them free. Now, the poem in its entirety is well worth the read. The poem was very well received once printed. Hannah had presented a call to both the Christian and nationalist conscience. Cowper had planned to write his own work on the subject, but deferred to the work already done by Hannah. The poem's influence lasted well into the next century, and it was credited with inspiring missionaries to take Christianity to Africa. Hannah continued to press the point home in her other writings. Several titles in her series of cheap repository tracts addressed the slavery issue. They often included passages written from the viewpoint of the slaves themselves, providing hard-hitting personal reality to the poems and stories. One example was of a mother named Yamba, who lost her child during the voyage, then suffered under a cruel taskmaster. At one point, she escaped to the sea and contemplated suicide. But she encountered an English missionary who shared the gospel with her. Yamba put her trust in the Lord and was baptized, though she never lost her love for her native Africa. Hannah's poems, including The Feast of Freedom, 1819, were translated into local dialects and other languages so they could be better understood by the locals. Alexander Johnson, Chief Justice of Ceylon, where he was instrumental in abolishing slavery, wrote perhaps overly effusively of Hannah because of her writings. What a pleasure must it afford you, my dear madam, to have the power of producing such moral improvement by your writings, not only throughout Europe, but throughout Asia also. for I am convinced that your writings have had a greater effect and have been more generally read than any other works which have been written for the last 100 years. These writings by Moore and others were essential to the abolitionist movement because they helped expose the evils of the slave trade to people in the nation from which it was largely hidden. Wilberforce's appeal to Parliament in 1788 was postponed due to one of his frequent illnesses. However, the speech he delivered in 1789 became known as, quote, one of the finest in the golden age of parliamentary oratory. Progress was made by the abolitionists in building social and political pressure over the next few years. Two great events would intervene to slow the abolition cause: the industrial, economic, and French military economic revolutions. King George, for example, was opposed to abolition, fearing the end of slavery would paralyze the nation in a time of war, and many of his subjects followed suit. John Wesley had warned Wilberforce of the magnitude of the fight against the slave trade. Quote, unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you will be worn out by the opposition of men and devils. But if God be for you, who can be against you? End quote. Victory was achieved slowly, sometimes with just a single clause of the slave bill being passed. Example, 1794. Hannah wrote, Lord, hasten the time when true liberty, light, and knowledge shall be diffused over the whole earth. However, in 1807, the Slave Trade Act, officially an act for the abolition of the slave trade, was passed. An act of the Parliament of the United Kingdom prohibiting the slave trade in the British Empire. It would not be until July 26, 1833, however, with the passing of the Slavery Emancipation Act, where slavery was to be officially ended and all slaves freed within a year. You're probably aware that Wilberforce died 3 days later. Perhaps you didn't know that Hannah Moore died on September 6th, 2 months after the death of her dear friend. In an age when the role of women was severely limited, Hannah was a rather remarkable woman, used by the Lord within her social restrictions to help bring about social and spiritual reform. She was one of the many individuals often in the background of the movement, but making an impact nonetheless. Wilberforce made a very revealing statement in one of his letters. Quote, I really look up to God with renewed thankfulness. I say renewed, for his having by his good providence drawn me to the abolition business has always appeared to me to call for the most lively gratitude. Individuals who are not in Parliament seldom have an opportunity of doing good to considerable numbers. Even while I was writing the sentence, I became conscious of the falsehood of the position. Witness Mrs. Hannah Moore and all those who labor with the pen. Moral reform through school on Sunday. The Moore sisters certainly knew how to create and run a successful school. They had already begun several. However, these were for those who could pay for tuition and generally represented families in the upper class. Hannah and her sister Patty began to have concerns for the local children who had no education at all. Wilberforce, visiting her at Cowslip Green, also exhorted her to consider ways to deal with the challenges faced by the poor and uneducated in the area. He told her, if you will be at the trouble, I will be at the expense. Just a note aside there, he was invited there for a time of relaxation, and Hannah and Patty said, why don't you go out and enjoy the countryside, the beautiful mountains and the hills and the ocean and so on. And so off he went. He really didn't want to go, but he eventually went. And he came back, and all he had seen was the little towns and the villages and the misery of the people. And he had paid no attention whatsoever to the things around. And that's what really stirred him to push Hannah and the sister, Patty, to pursue some social reform. So he'll be at the expense. They decided the best approach was to start up classes on Sunday, the one day off for working children, perhaps following the lead of Robert Raikes, commonly referred to as the one who began the Sunday school movement. Note, not like those of our day, but they were a time to teach basic literary and knowledge skills. In the Moore Sunday schools, reading, writing was not part of her curriculum, was almost totally given over to scripture and catechisms, though a little arithmetic was included along with knitting and spinning. There were many who opposed them. Teaching those set aside for labor might give them ideas and desires beyond their rightful station. Evangelism was just in its infancy to foreign lands, for example, William Carey at this time, and it was highly suspect even in the villages around Cowslip Green. Was this some sort of Methodism skulking about the countryside and threatening the Church of England? The poverty around them was debilitating, the immorality shocking, the church presence non-existent, the ignorance all-encompassing, the drinking out of control, and knowledge of the Christian faith was not to be found. No one in the village believed control. No one in the village believed these two women would follow through on their promise for a school. But before long, with the school bells ringing, about 130 girls arrived at the door of the school in Cheddar. They faced well-established bigotry towards the poor, as summed up by one landowner's wife. The poor were intended to be servants and slaves. It is preordained that they should be ignorant. We cannot alter what is decreed. They plugged on, however, and through multiple interactions, conversations, and demonstrations of sincerity, they convinced a significant number of people that they had, in fact, come to do them good. When they were finished, over a dozen of these schools had been established. In a letter to Wilberforce, she stated, "Many reprobates were by the blessing of God awakened, and many swears and Sabbath breakers reclaimed. There were many accounts of clearly converted young people. By 1796, there were between 1,600 and 1,700 students at schools in 10 parishes. The impact spilled over into families, as evidenced by an increase in the Cheddar congregation from 25 to 500. They held evening readings of sermons, prayers, and hymns for the parents. Again, there are numerous accounts of transformation of character and behavior of all ages. The Moore sisters also worked to alleviate social ills through friendly societies that helped with financial support during times of illness, childbirth, and funerals. The villagers enjoyed festive traditions financed by the Moores that actually brought some of the wealthier neighbors into a social setting with the working ladies. They held an annual feast for the children, all you can eat, in a picnic setting where the children demonstrated their knowledge through biblical and catechism recitals. At one such feast, there were 517 children and about 300 others. The event drew 4,000 spectators. This is a much changed neighborhood than the one that affected Wilberforce and others so significantly just a few years prior. Opposition from the established church, however, was never far away. Dissenters and nonconformists had been dealt with. Methodists were unwelcome, and when one of the teachers hired by Moore at the Blagden School was found to be praying extemporaneously, such a Methodistical practice, in sessions outside the school day, it created a national controversy. Enrollment plunged from 200 to 35. Fear of the curate was very real. The next 3 years, 1800 to 03, were difficult for all the Moore sisters. Hannah was denounced publicly, cruelly, and thoroughly. In 1802, she complains that she has been battered, hacked, scalped, tomahawked for 3 years. Flyers were posted along the road telling people where to find, quote, the menagerie of five female savages of the most desperate kind, end quote. Hannah was accused of disloyalty, revolutionary politics, and not believing one word of Christianity. In one of her letters, she spoke of what her true position was. My very soul is sick of religious controversy. Christianity is a broad basis. Bible Christianity is what I love. A Christianity practical and pure, which teaches holiness, humility, repentance, and faith in Christ, and which, after summing up all the evangelical graces, declares that the greatest of these is charity. Though vindicated in the end, the controversy took its toll, and she suffered from extreme illness for over 2 years. She took comfort in the writings of many solid men, especially that of the Puritan Richard Baxter. History would show Hannah to be an excellent educator and one who understood the needs of children in her age. Songs, stories, and lively teaching were hallmarks of her schools, as were analogies and illustrations from the world nearby. Her purpose in reform in all these areas was first and foremost religious and not political or social. Reading enabled individuals to see the principles of Christianity in the Bible itself. The novelist E.M. Forster said of Moore's efforts with the Sunday schools that she taught the poor how to read and wash, observe Sunday, and honor the King, and before her day, no one had taught them anything. The Clapham Sect. 4 miles from London Bridge sits the historic Clapham District. It was becoming a country escape for city dwellers who built palatial homes in the area. Many would attend the local church, though few were personally devout. Henry Thornton, an MP and cousin of Wilberforce, purchased a house there that would become the main gathering place for a unique set of individuals. He appointed a new curate, John Venn, and the church began to grow monumentally, and the building had to be expanded. There was a vibrant evangelism taking root within Clapham, and as a result, a number of true believers, who believed serious Christian faith could actually make a difference in the world, made this place their home away from home. Over the years, Wilberforce and Moore took up residence for extended periods of time. Others who attended were Henry Venn, that's John's father, James Stephen, a lawyer, Zachary Macaulay, Thomas Gisborne, an author and clergyman, Charles Grant, chairman of the directors of the British East India Company. Hannah was the only woman of the group, granted a status on par with these men. They were all faithful members of the Church of England, but represented the evangelical movement that was rising both within and outside the established church. These like-minded believers were bound together by shared moral and spiritual values, by religious mission and social activism, by love for each other, and by marriage. They sought to serve God in every area of their lives, personal and public, at home and abroad. They found a way to utilize each person's particular gifts to achieve their goals. Often these goals, such as abolition, were pursued and achieved with the help of co-belligerents, those outside their circle of personal conviction. Hannah seemed particularly gifted in creating bridges without letting go of her convictions, one she was happy to share with those colleagues in activism. She tended to shun labels, Arminian, Calvinist, Evangelical, and sometimes being too narrow. They seemed to her to do little more than create and energize swirling doctrinal controversies. She was Church of England enough to remain uncomfortable with some of the extemporaneous prayers often at Thornton's home. The Clapham sect, or circle, as they were sometimes called, were sympathetic to the dissenters and particularly intolerant to the Church of Rome. The mixing with these deemed suspect by the Church of England, such as Newton and his association with dissenters and with the occasional Baptist sharing his pulpit, did not stop them from cooperating with them if society was indeed to be reformed. Though the entire society was in their sights, the most visible impact was with the abolishment of the slave trade. Their efforts were directed at both upper and lower classes. Wilberforce was instrumental in obtaining an official proclamation against many social vices, gambling, drunkenness, etc., with apparent broad-based social support. They conducted research, circulated petitions, undertook boycotts, and published pamphlets, treaties, and poems. Moore contributed with two key works, one being Thoughts on the Importance of the Manners of the Great to General Society. Her writing was such that, in a day when religious books were out of fashion in the upper class, they were some of the most widely read books of the day, each work going through several editions in a short time. Others in the group, such as Wilberforce, contributed excellent and influential writings as well. Under the direction of Zachary Macaulay, they produced the well-read Christian Observer. Hannah was a regular contributor, and her usual wit and vivacity helped prevent it from, quote, sinking under its own solemnity, unquote. They also encouraged Sabbath observance, the ending of dueling, prison reform, crime prevention. They wrote and provided sound reading material for those learning to read. They helped establish the aid for slaves in Sierra Leone. In 1813, they succeeded in inserting a missionary clause in the newest East India Charter. Here they were hoping to see more of the gospel going to India. They ultimately established the Church Mission Society, which is still in operation today. The Claphamites were also very generous in giving to these programs. There were many philanthropic societies founded as well. In spite of shortcomings, they infused society with benevolence and compassion on a scale not previously seen. The Victorian age was about to arise with its emphasis on religion, morality, family, and duty. Hannah Moore has been called by some the first Victorian. Hannah was not a revolutionary. She was appalled by the violence of the French Revolution, writing to Wilberforce in 1790 that she conceived an utter aversion to liberty according to the present idea of it in France. But a reformer who believed reformation must start at the top of the societal and political ladder. Particularly with the upper class, she promoted responsibility, not rights, and duty, not democracy. She wrote extensively on manners, which really meant morality. One such treatise was Thoughts on the Importance of Manners of the Great, which sold out 7 editions in 3 months. This was followed by an even more penetrating book, identifying the superficiality and inconsistency of religion within the upper class, entitled An Estimate of the Religion of the Fashionable World by One of the Laity. She then penned one of her most celebrated papers, which was a pamphlet to the poor, Village Politics. It was actually published anonymously to start. A treatise over and against Thomas Paine's Rights of Man. It achieved phenomenal circulation, as did her counterpoint to a print of a speech by Jacques Dupont in France, who was calling for an end to religious teaching and a call to admire nature, cultivate reason. One of her most influential works, however, was Strictures on the Modern System of Female Education with a View of the Principles and Conduct Prevalent Amongst Women of Rank and Fortune. Long titles. Which outlined and promoted a balanced approach to female education. It speaks of modesty, growing old gracefully, the pursuit of light, liberty, and knowledge. It also came with a number of condemnations, such as ending baby balls, the 18th century equivalent of child beauty pageants for 4 to 8 year olds. Proper religious education was also a central plank to any useful education. The inculcation of the Christian faith, Moore argued, should not be left to personal whim or mere chance. Do young persons then become musicians and painters and linguists and mathematicians by early study and regular labor? And shall they become Christians by accident? Well, time is up. We can't examine Hannah's concern for animal welfare, especially in the blood sports, a concern shared by Wilberforce and Cowper. She wrote against these practices in some of her cheap repository tracts. They help establish Britain's first animal welfare laws and establish the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals in 1824. Her collected works in 1801, before she finished writing, totaled 8 octavo volumes. Though she published 11 books after the age of 60, her only novel, Celebs in Search of a Wife, emerged in 1807. By 1817, it had gone through 15 printings and was one of the most widely read books of the day. It was a novel on love and marriage that emphasized, unlike almost all others at that time, the importance of the personal and spiritual aspects of a marriage union over against the political or economic ones. Hannah was clearly a woman raised up by God to be tremendously influential in an age when women were not expected to be heard, certainly not in the public square. We'll let a writer in the Christian Observer have the final word on her. Quote, what Wilberforce was among men, Hannah More was among women. End quote.